The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to an exciting episode of Arthropod. I am your only host today, Michael Scavarla, and I am joined by one of our graduate students, Denise, and I am so sorry. Can you pronounce your last name?
Montelongo.
Okay. Thank you. I didn't want to screw it up.
It's fine.
It screws my last name up, so I just thought I would ask. So thank you. And thanks for agreeing to talk to me today. Denise is, well, why don't you tell everybody who you are and what you're doing here?
My name is Denise Montelongo. I'm a master's student, a first year master's student at Penn State University. My advisor is Dr. Andy Deans, who's actually the director of the Frost Entomological Museum here at Penn State. And I work with gall-inducing wasps, specifically those from the tribe Cynipinae, which are oak. They gall on oaks. And there's a lot of things that I look into, so it's kind of hard to be like, this. I work on this in particular, but yeah. There's a lot of things going on.
Okay. Maybe that's a good introduction. We'll get into specifics about what you're doing in a little bit.
Yeah.
But I did want to start out, just in case listeners aren't familiar, you mentioned you're working on gall-inducing wasps. What exactly is a gall?
So a gall is essentially an abnormal growth on plant tissues, and it can be due to excessive cell division or an increase in cell size. And then there's many things that could induce these galls. So it's not only arthropods. So there's also viruses, bacteria, fungi, nematodes that can also induce these galls. So it's not just insects.
Okay. And within the insects, it's not just wasps either. There's other...
No, there's an array of things that can induce these galls. So there's beetles, there's moths, there's trips. There's also other kinds of wasps besides the ones I study. Bees, so hemipterans, so true bugs, and also in flies.
So there's a lot of different things that make galls. Do they... what's the question I'm trying to ask? Do they all induce galls in a similar way?
No, they don't. So because what they're all trying to do is overcome like the plant's immune system, they have developed different ways of doing so. And because they all arrive to this in different ways, it's kind of hard to study how exactly they do the induction in these plants. So for example, on Cynipinae, which I study, it's not really well known, and it's sort of guess on how things happen. So we know that it's actually the egg and the larvae that induces the gall, not necessarily the mother when she oviposits her eggs into the plant tissue.
Okay. Mm. So then if they're overcoming the plant defenses, do gall insects, are they host specific then? Like, are similar looking galls on different plants produced by different insects or the same insect?
So what happens is each gall, because they've sort of arrived, each species sort of arrive at this in different ways. They all have different morphology. So you can have very distinct galls on the same tree. And they are mostly plant specific. So that way you can figure out, that's how many people are able to identify galls by how it looks like and what kind of species the gall is on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've tried identifying galls. It's not always easy. All the references are from like the 30s and 40s.
Oh, yes.
Not
yes.
Very up to date. I would love like a really nice photo guide to galling insects.
I would want one too, actually. Yes. So the best guide that we currently have is it's from the 50s. It's from 1959. It's by Louis H. Weld, who focused a lot of his research on northeastern cynipid gulls. And the pictures are black and white, and it's just descriptions. It's a little bit of mayhem over here in this kind of, in this realm. Yeah. So my PI and actually working on creating a updated version of Weld's gull identification guide.
That would be amazing. I hope that comes out soon because
Yes. Yes. It can be really hard because you're basing what you're finding on a description, and then just a description can be quite subjective. So it can be like, oh, thin, but like how thin? Like how thin is the wall of this gall? So it's a little weird. But there are a lot of people currently working on gall wasps. So I think there's momentum to actually get this done.
Good. So to have a guide like that, we need to know what most of the species are. Otherwise, you're just saying it makes this gall. We don't know what it is. Is that a problem? Because I know in most groups, there are large percentages of the species that are unknown. Like, do we know the species that are making most of these galls? Or do you have to rear them out? And are they undescribed? Or
so the biggest issue with cynipid galls is that they have alternating generations. So they essentially, most of them there's two generations per year, and you'll have a sexual generation and an asexual generation. And when it occurs, it's species dependent. For example, the hedgehog gall wasp, which induces on white oaks. So you'll have the asexuals emerge out of galls found on the leaves in the fall. And then once they emerge, the females will oviposit on the buds, and then in the spring, the sexuals will emerge out of the buds. So it's a little bit of a mayhem because you don't know that these two that are the ones that are coming out of the buds and the ones that are coming out of the leaves are actually the same species. And so this has happened throughout all the time that we've been studying cynipids. So there's a lot of species that we have, maybe only the sexuals or maybe just the asexuals. And then there's some that we know that which is which, and others we think they're different species, but they're actually the same. So it's a bit of a mayhem because they don't make the same kind of gall morphology on both. So it can look like a little rosette on the buds, and then it can look like a little ball with spikes on the leaf. So it's a completely different morphology. And it's just a lot of the ways that they have been found to be related is through observation, specifically the hedgehog gall. That's how it was found. The scientists studying it specifically saw it emerge out of the leaf and then observe it climb up the tree and like into the bud and oviposit on the bud. So it's a lot of intense rearing, and you have to rear a lot of galls to do this.
That sounds very complicated, but like it would be a fun project. I also imagine there's maybe some DNA work that you could do, just sequence every gall wasp you can find. And when you have the same sequence, then you can match those two generations up.
Yeah, we can do that now. However, that's obviously a bit pricey.
Yeah. Sequencing a lot of things is always expensive.
Yeah. So yeah, that's now the solution that we have, thankfully. And I can only imagine how people in the 30s and 50s did it, because that's actually so we have Alfred Kinsey, who's well known for studying cynipids, who later on went to study human sexuality.
It's and okay, you can say that. That's fine.
No. I actually couldn't remember what the word was. I was like,
We all know about Kinsey.
Yes. So he initially in the 30s used to study cynipid gall wasps, and he actually, there's a lot of species that he was the one who first identify them and describe them. And so there was a lot of work in the 30s, then followed by Weld in the 50s. But since then, it kind of died down. And then there was a resurgence of gall wasp in the 80s. And then right now, in the 90s, there seems to be like a generational thing. Like it gets picked up every now and then.
Huh. Well, that's really cool. Galls are neat. So then when these wasps make the galls on the trees, like does it hurt the tree? Because they're obviously an abnormal growth, but does that affect tree health or does it matter?
So it depends on the health of the tree. There's some that don't necessarily affect them because what the gall is doing is just like a resource sinkhole. So it's manipulating the plant to give it nutrients so that the larvae can continue to grow inside of the gall. But there are cases where it can end up killing a tree if it's just like a giant plague pest on the tree. So I know there are cases, but I haven't seen any on oaks.
Okay.
So they can be quite sturdy trees.
Oaks get a lot of pests.
They do, though.
Were you familiar with gall wasps or galls in general before you started your master's? Or is this something that's like completely new to you?
So this is completely new to me. I didn't really know about galls beforehand. And it pretty much started when I started my master's. Before, I used to study grasshoppers on prairies in the state of Texas, which is completely opposite of this. And that's mostly where my background mostly lied. But in conjunction with macronutrients interactions on grasshoppers. So this is completely new to me and it seemed very, very interesting. So it was why I took on the challenge to study this. But yeah.
That's very different. So I've seen you bringing in like galls and having them in bags. And I know you've got a space out in some barn somewhere. So can you describe that process a little bit
so they used to be reared in a sort of incubator sort of situation that we had. But then once COVID happened, I actually brought them all in into my apartment.
Oh my.
Yeah. So they're actually in my apartment and all the ones that I've collected this year are just laid out on the floor because they are very susceptible to getting moldy. So they're on Ziploc bags that I then have to perforate just to like let any of the moisture out. And then I check them every other day, but
oh, wow.
they're not in our barn. We were supposed to have them out in like a outdoor barn so that they would experience the natural temperature changes throughout the day, but we don't have them like that because I can't go check them every day because they limit the amount of people that can be out there.
Yeah. Science during a pandemic. So what is your apartment just full of little baggies with galls in them?
Pretty much. Yes.
Oh no.
Yes. I lay them out in a way that they're organized and I can go through them pretty quickly, but yes, if not, it's a little bit of mayhem over here. Yes.
So since you're just getting in the galls in the last year or two, do you have a favorite that you found? Like, is there any in particular that you find really striking or you like, you know, you find it and you get excited?
Actually, so recently, as of last week, I found a gall called the common name Satanslucent gall wasp, and it's on a red oak, and I could see it, and it looked like a bouncy ball essentially, and I wasn't sure if it was completely solid until I got it down, and then I like squeezed it, and it was completely solid, and it actually emerged yesterday. So, and it's quite a hefty gall wasp. Normally they're about 2 millimeters in length, but this one's about like 3 to 4 millimeters in length.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it's like pink. It looks like a bouncy ball, like completely. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It's quite funny to just see like a weird, this, because the thing is, like, this is done completely by the plant. So the insect's the one that's sending the signals into the plant to build this weird looking thing that's growing out of a leaf in this case. So, and they're completely different. So this, the translucent gall wasp, it's round, smooth, it's pink. And there's others that are small and fluffy. Others have little spikes. Others are, there's different colorations. There's some that change as they mature. So they'll start green and they'll end up pink or red. So there's also a, like, an aposematic coloration happening with galls. So it's not only, so because of there's coloration, there's also texture, because that can affect then parasitoids when they come to try to overtake the gall. Because what they do is the female will then tap her little antennae on the gall to determine where the chamber is, because she then has to, essentially, it's a game of, it's like she's playing a target game. So she kind of has to aim it correctly. Otherwise, it's she won't be able to get her eggs into the chamber and then her kids, so then her larvae or her egg won't take over.
Okay. So that brings up a question. I mean, you mentioned that there are other parasitoids that attack the gall wasps. Is that very common? Are they very diverse? Like, I guess, could you tell us a little bit about the parasitoids that attack the gall wasps, if you know about them?
So there's some are generalist and some are species specific, but the timing has to be correct for a parasitoid to be able to take over a gall. So that's essentially what's doing. Once a gall, it's up to a certain size, the parasitoid can detect it, and then the female will go tap her antennae on the gall and then determine where the chamber, where the inducer's larvae is, because she then has to aim for it and oviposit her egg. And so once that has happened, the larvae of the inducer will essentially stop feeding, and that will become what the parasitoid feeds on. But there's not only parasitoids, there's also inquilines. So inquilines, these things are just being attacked left and right. So there's inquilines which won't necessarily feed on the inducer's larvae. It will just, like, hang out and also eat the nutritional tissue that is found inside of the gall. But depending on whether or not they are of the same order or not, because there are other inquilines, there's not just like a wasp and another wasp. It can be a coleoptera, it can be a lepidoptera. There's other kinds of inquilines. Depending on what order it is, that will determine the fate of the inducer, because the nutritional tissue is determined by the signals that is being sent to the gall. So it can end up killing the inducer's larvae by accident. Okay.
Just because they screw with the signal and then
yes,
stops growing, or
essentially the food is not the correct one, and it can just, things can change.
Okay. So are a lot of the galls that you rear out parasitized? Like, do you get upset when, like, all of a sudden there's these wasps or beetles or moths or something that you weren't expecting that had taken over the gall? Can you tell if it's parasitized?
Yes. So you can tell, and normally what happens is the older the gall is, the more likely it is that it will have a parasitoid. So you can tell because the parasitoids belong to the family Chalcidae, so they could look completely different than the inducer once they've emerged. And actually, I don't get upset. It's cool. It's kind of a cool thing to find out, because then you have like a food web of like what things are interacting with this particular species, which can then be used to find out what kind of pressures this particular species is under. So it's, so now you know like what's being attacked by and what's being, what it's being exposed to, and then you compare, you can use it to compare it with other galls and see how like specialized this parasitoid is, or if this is a new parasitoid, because there are cases where gall wasps are introduced to new areas, and then you can see how generalist, like how easy it can find a parasitoid that it will attack it on. Yeah.
So are you working on any of that, or is that something that the lab more generally is thinking about, like saving these parasitoids and asking some of these other questions?
So that's one of the things I'm working on, is use saving the parasitoids to find, like, essentially create its, the food webs that are occurring in these galls. What my lab is mostly focused on right now is actually creating a phylogeny for cynipidae. Because it is not well studied, there's a lot of what they call combs in our trees. So, like, it's not very... We don't know exactly how well things are related to what. And that kind of becomes an issue when figuring out what genus things belong to, because there's not really a good species identification guide. And so it's not, there's things that belong to different genuses, and but things are not explained correctly why. It's just, it's a bit of a mess. So having the phylogeny would then help clear out like what kind of things belong where, and then things can be sorted correctly.
Okay. I guess that kind of gets at another question I was going to ask. If all of these galls look different, you know, some are spiky or different colors, like does that, do we know if, you know, sister species have similar looking galls, or are they wildly different, or... You know, or is this whole group of wasps making pink smooth galls and this other group of wasps making different galls? But if we don't know how things are related, and if things are in different genera when they should be, like they're assigned the wrong genera, I guess you just can't even get at that until you get a good phylogeny.
Yeah, it seems like right now that's kind of how they are divided. Whenever I go out gall hunting, and then I will normally use iNaturalist to sort of figure out what it is, if I don't know. And I can, because of it, I've actually been able to kind of tell that, okay, these more like bigger, smoother looking galls normally belong to this genus. And that's, so you can kind of tell that's sort of how they originally been categorized. But yeah, they definitely need some clarification so we can move forward and do more research on this, because a lot of things are not clear, so it's kind of hard to proceed when things are then going to change.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and because of that, there's a lot of species that have had a bunch of name changes.
Jeez, that's got to be a nightmare.
Yes, yeah, so when you're going through the literature, it can have, depending on what year it is, you kind of have to be conscious of like what to look for.
I think that takes care of all the questions I had. Is there anything else that you want to tell the listeners about gall wasps or your projects? Or is there anything that we didn't cover that you think people should know about galls?
So there's some galls that actually can take up to 3 years to mature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's actually a gall called the horn oak gall wasp, which grows on red oaks. And the gall will form on the branch, and the branch will then sort of will have this like weird, almost like bulge, if you will, and that the females in those galls can actually take up to 3 years. So that's one of the tricky things with gall collecting is that you sometimes don't know how long you have to wait for things to emerge. And then once the horn oak gall wasps emerge, then they will oviposit on the leaves. And then the ones on the leaves, once those emerge, will then find like a very young branch to oviposit on.
Oh, I guess that brings up a good question. Where are most of the galls being laid? Are most of them on the leaves, or are they also hitting stems and branches?
Yeah, so they're hitting stems, branches, buds, roots. It seems like sometimes they like to overposit it on buds and leaves. That's what it's predominantly been found. However, there's recently there's been talk about bark galls. So, yes. So that's one of the things we're actually, there's a lot of little things that we're looking into, but yeah, bark calls would be, it's something that we're trying to figure out because there's some speculation that they could just be boars. So, because you can kind of see the little hole once they emerge, but like a gall doesn't necessarily have to be protruding elsewhere. It can change the inner structure of the trunk. Mm-hmm. So there's one thing that like, oh, maybe there's like a bias towards leaves and buds because those are the things that we can't see. But what if there's all these other galls in the trunks or on the trees?
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Like it makes a gall that just goes in instead of coming out.
Yeah. Yeah. That has like an inner change inside because essentially a gall can have all these cell divisions, all these tissue changes. But if those tissue changes don't necessarily have to protrude out where they can stay inside and change the inner structure. And as long as it creates a chamber for the larvae to grow and give it the appropriate nutritional tissue, it will grow and then it will emerge.
Oh, that's cool. So are we rethinking about like the definition of galls then? If we're including this kind of thing or?
This is one of the hot topics that of galls. Yes. But yeah, and then one of the neat things about cynipids is that other gallers will make, before they pupate, they will make a little pre-exit hole on the gall so that once they pupate, they only have to really chew through part of the gall to exit out. But in cynipids, they actually don't make any holes before they pupate. So the adult is the one that has to then chew itself out. And because of this, there's been studies on the like metal deposits on the mandibles of galwas. Oh. So there, yeah.
Yeah, I imagine if you're like making the branch weird and woody and hard, and then you've got to chew out of that could be very difficult for a little
wasp. It is, yeah. And there's different hardness to the gall. So there's some that are quite paper thin and others that are quite, there's the morphology of the inside of the galls are very, very variable. So it's just and I'm pretty sure that's also, it can be an advantage or disadvantage for them.
Yeah, I can imagine like a real thin, paper thin gall would be a lot easier for parasitoids to attack, but much easier, like if you survive into an adult, it's easier to chew your way out.
Yeah, and actually one of the cool things about those, the more papery type galls is, so the one right now I'm thinking of is called the large oak apple gall, which is pretty common here in Pennsylvania. And essentially it has a gap in between the chamber and the outer gall. And because it's so large, the parasitoid would have to have a very large ovipositor to reach the chamber. So it has its benefits and it has to have like all these different kinds of galls. So because you're just, essentially it's like what will help this larvae survive? That's essentially the game here.
Thinking about that and the metal deposition, I assume we don't know, but I bet that changes depending on what kind of gall you're inducing. Maybe if you're making a thinner gall, you maybe don't have as much metal deposition in the mandibles, but I also assume nobody has looked at that.
I think they have. I haven't looked into too much because that's not what I look into, but I have read about metal deposition on jaws.
Okay. Anything else that you want to mention that listeners might find interesting about what you're doing or galls in general?
So not only do the larvae live in like a chamber, sometimes the chamber can be detached and just be rolling around inside of the gall.
That's
yes. So it works on the favor of the larvae because when the parasitoid then tries to aim for the chamber, it has a hard time getting to it.
Can the larvae in the gall like move it around like a Mexican jumping bean or something? Like, can they move and get it to avoid the parasitoid?
I'm not sure if it can, okay. But I know that because it's free inside of the gall, any movement of the leaf will move it around.
Oh, moves it around.
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Is that like while they're pupating then? If it's moving around and detached, then that's obviously not still like growing from the tree. Like there's no tissues connected.
Well, the thing is for that particular gall, once the larvae hatches out of the egg, there's this like sort of chamber that the larvae just grows in, and it grows its whole life in that little chamber. And that's the one that's detached from the gall.
Okay.
So it actually never has to like exit it until it's an adult. So it can pupate inside of there.
Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah. Which I remember seeing when I saw it for the first time, I thought it was an egg. I thought the egg, that's what the chamber was. But then someone dissected it in front of me, and then I could see the little larvae moving, and I was like, oh, it was quite neat.
So is that part of, I guess, like taking photos of galls and trying to build stock for a future field guide or ID guide? Are you dissecting galls and like taking photos of the cross section or the dissected gall? Is that important for identification?
So the reason why that particular one was being dissected, so we're also looking at the iliac gland and salivary glands of the larvae, because there is a distinct morphology difference between the inducers and the inquilines. So essentially a larvae is just a feeding machine inside of the gall. And it has two glands, the salivary gland and the iliac gland. And because we know the gall induction has to do with the larvae secretions and some sort of secretion from the egg, our lab is currently looking at iliac glands because we believe that has a role in gall induction and in gall signaling for it to like continue growing with the tree. So they do look different, and that's one of the reasons why we've been collecting not only galls when they're adults, but also when they're larvae, so that we can compare these sort of glands.
Okay. Has anybody looked at the signaling that the larvae do? Like, are they putting out like fake plant hormones or like,
yes,
know so, what they're doing?
Well, I don't particularly know.
Sure, sure.
But I do know that that's one of the things. It's one of the things that happens with other gall inducers. So they are like phytohormones. So they will essentially use plant hormones have been found on the tissues of gall inducers, not necessarily cynipids, but I do know that that seems to be how gall induction occurs. There's a lot of, that's really one of the things that we're looking into. And it's a very iffy sort of, there's a lot of unknowns in how induction occurs.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just so cool that there's so many different organisms, insects and otherwise, that do this. And like, we just have, like, I want it to be 100 years from now when we have all of this figured out, and to be able to compare like fungi are doing this and these group of insects are doing it this way. And like,
yeah,
that's just really cool.
So at least for bacteria, it is known, and for like fungi is somewhat known, but for arthropods, because there's so many and it's kind of a weird unknown area around here.
Galls are neat. We'll sum up the podcast that way. Cool. Well, that's all I have. So that sounds like a good place to wrap this up. Do you have, or is there any place that you want to direct listeners to, they want to follow you on Twitter, or do you have any social media that you want to plug or not? It's fine either way. Is there anything that you want to plug here at the end for listeners if they want to follow you or get a hold of you?
I mean, I don't use my Twitter.
It's
So they can actually sign up to the Frost Entomological Museum's newsletter, and that's one of the ways that we get out how our information on what's happening, not only in my lab, but at the Frost.
Okay, I can plug that in the show notes. In that case, you can find me, Michael Scavarla, on Twitter. My handle is at mscavarla36. You can find the show at arthro_podshow is our Twitter handle. So you can find us on the web there. You can find us on the internet at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. Well, Denise, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about your research and galls in general. I've really enjoyed this. I'm looking forward to seeing how your research wraps up because it's really exciting and I want to see your result. So yeah, thanks again.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.